Hello, I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager, and welcome to In Conversation With, the podcast series that delves into the world of financial services and brings you face-to-face with some of the most notable figures in the industry. Listen as we discuss topics that are currently facing the industry and hear from visionary CEOs to disruptive innovators as we bring you a diverse array of voices and perspectives. We'll explore the challenges they faced, the lessons they've learned, and the insights they have to share about the ever-evolving landscape of financial services. Hello and welcome to In Conversation With. I'm Kimberly Dondo, Digital Content Manager. And in today's episode, I'm joined by Emma Collins, partner at Waitmans. Thank you for joining me today, Emma.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Kimberly.
So if you could give us a bit of a background into yourself and how you got started in the industry.
Well, I arrived in the Northwest from Essex via Dorset at university and started my family law career about 30 years ago with an excellent mentor in Carol Atkinson. And from there, with many very good colleagues, we've built a national family team and a national private client presence across nine offices. So, that's a bit about where I come from.
Okay, so I feel like you are kind of an expert into the conversation we're going to be having today. So I wanted to start by asking if you can shed some light on the trends you've observed in prenuptial agreements in recent years and how they have evolved and what factors are driving these changes. Because I know this wasn't something a lot of people thought about. It was something that's probably just for the super rich or something, but I feel like more people are thinking about it and thinking of having them in place.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's certainly anecdotally, I would say we've seen a constant increase in prenuptial agreements over the last 10, 15 years, particularly. And I think the real turning point in this country was the case of Rademacher and Granatino in the Supreme Court in 2010, because essentially that said that with the right safeguards in place and as long as people are making an informed decision, so there's proper disclosure and they've had advice and that they are fair and not going to adversely impact any children, then they are going to be upheld by courts. And previously, and you still hear this said a lot, oh, they're not worth the paper they're written on, they're not binding. Well, no, they're not binding, but they are likely to be upheld, as I say, if those factors are taken into account. So as that awareness has increased with advisors, particularly with financial advisors, with lawyers, and then with the general population, that means more and more people will think to take that up as part of their protection and planning. And as you say, people realize that it isn't solely for the super wealthy and that they have real protection benefits for everybody, really, particularly for inherited wealth and protecting that and passing on of inherited wealth.
Right. And to go with prenuptial agreements, now a lot more people that might not have thought about that are looking at postnuptial agreements, which are gaining traction as well. So could you provide any overview of their prevalence and discuss their significance in today's marital landscape?
So a postnuptial agreement is essentially the same as a prenuptial agreement. It's just one that takes place before the marriage and one afterwards. That was decided and confirmed a while back in case law. They're both agreements. They're both agreements that seek to set out what will happen in the event that there is a relationship breakdown. So what about the prevalence of them? Prenups are more likely to occur than a postnup, but oftentimes postnups occur where their parents wanting to pass on family wealth, wanting maybe looking at restructuring their business, and they want to pass on shares or even just gift wealth, and they're advised by their financial advisors, by lawyers, that not to do that without their adult children having a nuptial agreement in place that protects that from potential marriage breakdown. So that's the circumstances in which you more often get a postnuptial agreement. So as to their prevalence, I'd say I was thinking about this earlier. This is totally anecdotal, but maybe a sort of 70-30% in favor of prenups, I would say, of the ones that come through our door anyway.
Mm-hmm. I think also, is there a possibility that some people might not have gained a certain amount of wealth, but then after, with years of marriage, they have started seeing that gain of wealth. So maybe they want to have that protection in place as well.
Yeah, it depends. Yes, it depends where that gain of wealth came from. As you say, if it's coming from inherited wealth, then certainly those are circumstances in which you might well consider a postnup. So want something when you're actually married. So yes, just the general accumulation of wealth within a marriage wouldn't be a reason to enter into a postnup, because you're other half would be unlikely to want to agree to that, because they would say that was a shared accumulation of wealth quite fairly. But if it's a wealth that's come from an outside source, inherited or is generally the example, or family just passing wealth on, then people are more amenable to thinking about that, because people understand, couples understand why family wealth is wanting to be protected and being able to be kept in the family and passed down the family line rather than potentially go out of the family on a relationship breakdown.
That is fair. And when advising clients on wealth protection, what are some key considerations regarding asset splitting during divorce proceedings? And how do you approach this very delicate aspect of financial planning?
Well, yeah, again, it is really, I suppose it depends firstly on which clients we're talking about, and secondly, on at what point they are in their marriage or not. So if it is the client's themselves, the people who are getting married, ideally they'll be speaking to somebody before they're married, therefore a prenuptial agreement is possible and absolutely advisable. If they're already married, then they could consider a postnuptial agreement. Sometimes people will enter into postnuptial agreements perhaps there's some fragility around their relationship, so that both parties know what things will look like and how it will work out if they do divorce, and then they can sort of park that and go back to trying to make their relationship work. But the other point, really, the really important point, is if you are receiving inherited wealth and you don't have a prenuptial agreement in place, do keep it separate. Don't intermingle it. Don't put it in joint names, because you then at least still will have some argument if the relationship breaks down for that to be treated as non-matrimonial wealth and not brought into the equation. If you're advising the parents and the people who are looking to pass on wealth, then again, it's a question of suggesting that their adult offspring have a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement, depending where they are in their relationship. And that, really harsh although it may sound, not passing on that wealth or making it a condition that you're not going to pass on that wealth or those shares in the business or whatever without your adult children having entered into an appropriate agreement to protect that. So, and I think from the point of view of the receiving people, it's easier for them sometimes to be able to broach that with their partner, because they can say, my parents aren't going to pass this. We won't as a family have the benefit of this money unless they know that it's adequately protected with a prenup or a postnup. So it's sort of, I think, perhaps a slightly easier conversation to have in that context.
Mm. And how do prenups and postnups differ in terms of legal implications and effectiveness? And what are the common misconceptions that you see surrounding these agreements? I guess a lot of those misconceptions might come from looking at the US legal system, which is, you know, where I think most people know prenups and postnups from.
Yeah, so they don't. So pre and postnups don't differ legally in their effectiveness. They are both an agreement, and fundamentally, you can only enter into an agreement. You can only do it by agreement, by definition. So it's not imposed on anybody. You can't make somebody enter into it. Misconceptions can be that they think they're not, that they are not effective. Because that, as I said at the beginning, is you often hear, oh, they're not worth the paper they're written on. Well, that's actually not true. No, they are not binding in this jurisdiction. That's correct. But as I said at the beginning, if they've been entered into appropriately and correctly, then the chances are, the high chances that they will be upheld if there is a divorce. So that's a common misconception. I mean, the states is unhelpful in some respect because, of course, it's different in every state as well, and so there are different legal effects. Prenups are potentially marginally better, not because they're different in their effectiveness, but because there's a bit more of an impetus to enter into one because you've got a deadline, you've got a marriage coming up, and you've got to do it by then. And in fact, ideally, at least 28 days before. So everybody is focused on getting it done. Whereas if you have a postnuptial agreement, there's sometimes no real end in sight, and it can drift and doesn't really occur. And as well, people can say that they won't marry unless there is a prenup in place. So there is we have to be careful because people can't enter them under duress because then they wouldn't be binding. But it is legitimate to say that I won't enter into this marriage unless we have a suitable prenup in place. So on the flip side, there is something to be said for calm consideration and not in the sort of the melee of running up to a wedding. So to be able to calmly consider it after the marriage, and perhaps less unromantic then in people's eyes. And so those are the advantages of a post-nuptial agreement.
Right. And in your experience, what are some of the most common pitfalls or oversights that clients make when it comes to wealth protection and relationships? And how can financial advisors help clients navigate these challenges alongside someone like you?
Yeah, I think the most common pitfalls I see are, again, with the parents gifting money. So many, many times, quite rightly, from their financial advisors, from their tax advisors' point of view, they may be advised to give money to their adult children for inheritance tax planning and so forth. But that is potentially just money that's going into a pot for division if there's a relationship breakdown. So to bring in a family lawyer and think about that, you have your financial planner, you have your tax advisor, you'd maybe have your wills and trust advisor, and the missing limb is often you haven't thought of it with a family law gloss in case relationships break down. You need to have thought of that element as well. Another area that is a pitfall I see is the reliance on trusts to protect. So trusts have their place and they're a very important part of financial planning, but to rely on those to protect money on divorce can be dangerous because trusts can actually be varied on divorce by the court has power if a court considers it to be a nuptial settlement, what they define as a nuptial settlement. A court can vary a trust in a divorce so that parents who think that they have protected wealth by putting it into trust for their offspring possibly haven't necessarily. So it's really, really important that the family law advice is taken at that time. At the same time, you're thinking of setting up trusts and ideally having a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement as well as the trust. So there's sort of layers of protection rather than just relying on trusts. Giving money outright and not relying on trusts, I'd say, were two of the biggest pitfalls. And really, it's the collegiate working really across disciplines to make sure you've covered all the bases or thought about them. Sometimes there's not an absolute solution because there's the tension of wanting to achieve one thing might be a tension between achieving another. But at least if you've done it with it, you've balanced the risks, you've thought about it, that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Given the complexities of asset splitting and wealth protection, what proactive steps do you recommend advisors to ensure their clients are well prepared for potential relationship changes?
I think it's take advice. It's because it will depend And so recommend to your clients that they take advice from a family lawyer, because it will depend on the circumstances of that client at any given time. As I've said, there's scope for postnuptial agreements, even if there is already a marriage. I think also keep inherited, from the client's perspective, keep inherited wealth separate. Keep an audit trail so that you can demonstrate that it was inherited wealth and that it's not been intermingled. And there's been no contribution by the other party to that wealth. Because the court will make a distinction, even if there's not a prenuptial agreement in place, between matrimonial and non-matrimonial wealth. If it's parents that you're advising rather than the individual, it's really part of the whole sort of jigsaw puzzle of advice. You'd be taking your financial planner's advice, you're taking tax advice, you're taking wills and trusts advice, possibly taking corporate advice if you've got a business and you're restructuring. Don't forget the family limb of it. Take that part as well. It may only need a half hour, an hour conversation, but just to point out what's available and what not to do. And the other thing, I suppose, is really not put anything in joint names if you can help it. That's not an absolute, but it helps. It's something that may help. And ultimately, and this is particularly unromantic, as the law stands at present, don't get married. That is the number one way of protecting your wealth, because cohabitants don't have any rights in England and Wales jurisdiction anyway. They have no rights as cohabitants. So it's a completely different scenario if a cohabiting relationship separates, where as opposed to a married couple separating. So the ultimate protection is simply not to marry in the first place.
I can't imagine having that conversation. No, I don't want to get married because I don't want to split my assets potentially later on. But it's one of those, I think it's a very difficult thing to separate the emotion from the logical aspect of it. Because right now I can be like, I understand why we should do a prenup, but I guess when your emotions are high, you would feel hurt in that moment. So I can only imagine the tightrope you have to walk sometimes when having those conversations.
I think so. And I always recommend being really open and transparent, because, having those discussions at an early stage, don't hijack your spouse-to-be with the idea sort of a few months before your marriage, because as you say, that's not going to be well received. It is hurtful, and people worry and understandably that their position won't be protected. Whereas if you can have an early and open discussion about what the motivation is behind this and what the logic is behind this, and to give an assurance that they will be protected, because the point of a prenup is not to say that the other person will get nothing. It's just to regulate what they will get and to put some limits around it. So there is an element of it gives certainty to the person, and it gives an element of protection. They know what they will get out of the other end of it. But that reassurance, as you say, you need to have those discussions and I've seen this in the past, where the first thing that people see is a letter from a lawyer saying, oh, here's a draft prenup. Would you like to think about signing it, please? It's not going to be well received, because ultimately you do need the agreement of the other person, obviously. Yeah. You need them to be on board and understand logic behind it and feel that they're being fairly treated within it.
Gosh, wow. I can't imagine anyone not even bothering to have the conversation, just sending a letter. So bad. But I wondered if there have been any recent legal developments or case precedents that advisors should be aware of when discussing wealth protection with their clients.
I suppose there's a constant refinement through the courts about what works and what doesn't work in prenuptial terms. Nothing has fundamentally altered on the what the safeguards are around prenuptial agreements and making sure that they're appropriate. I would, though, highlight again the point about the trusts, because I do think that many, not just financial advisors, but many wills and trusts lawyers are not necessarily wholly alive to the fact that, that trusts can be varied by courts in divorce situations, and nuptial settlements can be varied. It tends to be a last resort for a court, and if they can find other assets to deal with, they will do. But they can be, so therefore, people are putting in place trusts thinking that they've put sufficient protection in place to achieve what they wanted to achieve, and that's being undermined when it comes to it. So the trust point would be one of the biggest things I like to highlight, really, to financial advisors and to my fellow lawyers advising on the wills, trusts and the estate side of things. Just to, again, when you're thinking, it's not don't do a trust, but if you're thinking about having a trust, just think about the family impact of that. Have that conversation as well, because it may be that something can be done to make that more likely not to be varied, if that's not a double negative. And also, it may be that then the advice is the trust is fine, but you should also encourage a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement as well.
Right. And finally, we've talked about the emotion that can surround this topic. So how can financial advisors initiate conversations about prenups or postnups with their clients in a sensitive and supportive manner? And what strategies do you recommend for broaching this topic effectively?
I think the best way to approach it from a financial advisor's perspective is it's part of a comprehensive planning arrangement. And they do, you know, I'm aware that that's what financial advisors will do anyway. They will be advising about the financial aspects. They will probably be advising about wills and lasting powers of attorney, but advising that their clients should have those. They'll be advising their clients to take tax advice, possibly corporate advice, trust advice. All of that would be part of and insurance. And so they would be considering all those factors. And I think the way to introduce the family advice piece is to say, well, that is part of the overall jigsaw puzzle. It's part of the comprehensive planning. Whilst death is inevitable and divorce isn't inevitable, it is still highly prevalent in our society. So it's an omission not to factor that into your planning and to think about it. Think about it in the abstract rather than it's going to happen to you or to your adult children. Yeah, but it may do, because it does. And so I think that's probably the best way and most sensitive way to do it. It's just part of life planning, as opposed to, chances are you're going to get divorced, so we better sort that out.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's all very good advice. But thank you so much for having this conversation with me, Emma. It was very enlightening. And I think it kind of made me understand prenups and postnups a bit more, so that I don't get emotional about it personally.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Kimberly.
Thank you for listening to In Conversation With. We do hope that you enjoyed it. Please do keep up to date with all our new releases via Podbean, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your podcasts from. You can also keep up to date with all our new content published on the Money Marketing website, as well as our print edition Money Marketing magazine. So make sure to subscribe. Follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. See you next time.